This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. For many, Texas history is almost like a religion. Having it is a foundation for many to function. It requires big leaps of faith, and you don't mess with it. But the stories of the Alamo, San Jacinto, Spindletop, the invention of Dr. Pepper, that stuff is sacred. But Stephen Harrigan is here with his new book about Texas history, Big Wonderful Thing, and he brings Texas history into new focus into to serve today. If you got questions or comments about Texas history, history in itself, if you have a story about your family and its connection to Texas history, we'd love to hear it. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. Email us at thesource@tpr.org. Tweet us at tprsource. And if you think Texas is not well served with the version of Texas history that many of us know, call us as well. We want to hear that. 210-614-8980. Stephen Harrigan, welcome to The Source.
Thanks for having me here. Appreciate it.
Big, wonderful thing describes Texas, and it describes your book because it is big and is wonderful. It's certainly a thing.
It's definitely a thing. It's a heavy thing. It's about 5 pounds, I think.
Yeah, and over 900 pages.
Yeah.
And tell us about why you wanted to go deep digging into Texas history and tell it.
Well, it was not my idea to write the book. It was Dave Hamrick at UT Press who had this idea that it was time for a new Texas history, one that was sort of soup to nuts history from the beginning to the roughly the, I hope not the end, but roughly contemporary times. And he persuaded me to do it, and I was intrigued by the idea. It was such a gigantic undertaking, and it felt like I was the wrong person to do it because I'm not really an historian. I'm a novelist and a magazine writer and a screenwriter. But the more I thought about it, the more I realized, boy, do I want to write this book, because I've lived in Texas for most of my life, and I've seen a lot of Texas history. I've written about Texas a great deal, and particularly about Texas history. So it finally seemed something I couldn't say no to.
And why do you think we just can't use the old T.R. Fehrenbach books of Texas history? Why do we need to recast it?
Well, we can certainly still use or read T.R. Fehrenbach's classic history, which came out in 1968. It's a really striking book. But it doesn't advance the story as deep into, like, say, the 20th century.
It kind of runs out of gas right around the 20th century.
Yeah, I mean, I think Fehrenbach was more interested in the 19th century and previous centuries. And, you know, it's a hypnotic book. I made a point not to read it while I was working on my book because his prose is so powerful, and it could kind of slip into my own mind. I didn't want to be repeating phrases or repeating rhythms that Fehrenbach had written. But, you know, there's always room for a new history. This came out 2 weeks ago. There's probably room for another one now because there's always a lot happening. There's always a lot of different interpretations and different perspectives. And this is just happens to be my version of it.
And Fehrenbach, he was really conservative. He was a conservative guy. He was a conservative columnist. Mm-hmm. And did that come into his telling of Texas history?
Well, I think no matter your political beliefs or no matter your upbringing or your where you live.
Politics aside, but just your view on life, I think, and being a conservative, it's a philosophy. Uh-huh. It's more than a should be a philosophy more than a political stripe.
Yeah, I think he did. I think it was a there's a certain, you know, you read Fehrenbach's, which I haven't done again since I began writing this book, so I'm not that up to speed on it. But I remember vividly how it sort of presented the Texas history as a sort of titanic struggle between Anglo settlers and between Mexicans and Native Americans, and it felt to me like a kind of the story of this triumph of Anglo Texans.
Yeah, precisely.
And I think it's and in his own time, that may have made more sense than it does today.
Yeah, because it was written during the Cold War.
Right.
And it was also seems to be almost like a rationalization or justification for Texas being what it is.
Well, yeah, and I'm not sure you could call it a rationalization, but it was his interpretation of how Texas got to be the way it was. And I think we just know, you know, we've had more history since 1968, obviously. We've had more historians digging deeper into the story and learning more about and telling us more about the various kinds of people who made up this state and how it wasn't a kind of binary thing. It was a very complex, multi-ethnic, multicultural stew that led to the way Texas is now.
And how did you start? What was the first thing you said, I'm going to write this? I don't think you started at the very beginning and worked your way towards the end. You just sort of worked your way, here's something I want to cover, and then how did that work?
I began sort of instinctively feeling that I did not want to begin this book with lava and bacteria and the formation
the Big
of
Bang.
The earth. I wanted to write a book that would appeal to people now, and I wanted to sort of signal to the reader that I was taking recent history into account, that this book would take us up more or less to the present. And so it just occurred to me one day, a good way to start this book would be with Big Tex catching on fire at the Texas State Fair. And I thought that image was so disturbing and so weird.
I took that to be a metaphor.
Yeah, I think you can take it to be a metaphor, although a metaphor of what?
It's well, about Texas history.
Yeah.
I mean, I thought you were, it was a metaphor about that you have history. You have to burn it down to rebuild it, and the test history that we have is always is kind of based on some sort of self-identity.
Yeah, I mean, it was, you know, this cowboy burning down. You know, cowboy is this, you know, this 52 foot tall, I think, Big Tex.
Howdy, folks.
Yeah, right. He burned down. I mean, and that was that image of that cowboy was the image to the world. And an image to Texans of what Texas thought it was all about. And then suddenly it just erupts into flames. And the other thing about...
Right in time for the newscast. Too.
Right.
All the live shots. Big Texas burning right behind me, right, ladies and gentlemen.
It was horrible to watch, but also fascinating, you know.
And then it came back. We're going to make him bigger and better.
They made him bigger and better. And with less flammable material. But the other thing about Big Tex is that he stood and still stands on the fairgrounds in Dallas, which was where the 1936 Centennial Exposition, which was a birthday party that Texas gave for itself on the 100th anniversary of its independence from Mexico. So there's lots of resonance there.
Sure, but there was a big tug of war between San Antonio and Dallas about who was going to get that centennial celebration. And a lot of people thought San Antonio was the logical place to have it. Mm-hmm. And it didn't happen. And a lot of people that Dallas outmaneuvered San Antonio to get that. And it's been a rivalry ever since.
Absolutely. And also Fort Worth was a rival too, and yeah, they had their own counter exposition.
We're going to take a break. The number to call in, 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. Stephen Harrigan, author of Big Wonderful Thing, A History of Texas. If you've got questions or comments, you've got a story about your family in Texas history, we'd love to hear it, 210-614-8980. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davis. We're talking about Texas history. There is this new tome. It is a very ambitious book called Big Wonderful Thing, A History of Texas. Stephen Harrigan's the author. Can you tell us about, and the number to call in is 210-614-8980. We really want to hear your stories, your own family stories about how involvement with Texas history. So Stephen Harrigan, why this quote? Tell me about the quote.
Well, the title of the book, Big Wonderful Thing, comes from a quote from George O'Keefe, the famous painter, who lived in Texas when she was a young woman a couple different times, once in Amarillo and then once in Canyon, south of Amarillo. And she wrote to her friend back east that I couldn't believe Texas was real. For me, it was the same big, wonderful thing that oceans and the highest mountains are. And I was looking for a title for the book. And, you know, some of the titles were already taken. Lone Star was taken by T.R. Fehrenbach, as we know. James Michener appropriated the word Texas as a title for his book. And so I was looking for something that sounded good, that sounded inviting, that sounded like it sort of caught the vibe of the sense of awe that many of us feel about Texas, this you know, gigantic, kind of indefinable state. And I came across that quote from George O'Keefe, and it just felt right. Felt like it was a way to invite the reader in to have a conversation about what Texas is and means.
Some people have said that you're part of a movement trying to fix Texas history. Are you doing that?
I'm not aware of any movement that I'm part of. I'm trying to, I have tried to write the history of Texas with as, clear a sense of what really happened as I could. I don't have a revisionist agenda or anything like that, but it just felt to me like there was so much to write about, so much that had maybe been, not noticed so much in previous histories or not, worked into the story as deeply as it should have been. So, it's not, like I say, it's not an agenda. It's not, if there's a movement, nobody's notified me that I'm a member of it, but I'm just kind of working on my own, trying to understand this place.
And, but we're trying to figure out how Texas history serves us. Mm-hmm. It's not just a thing in and of itself, a big, wonderful thing in and of itself. It has to be a reflection of who we are today, mm-hmm. as we try to figure out how did we get here.
Yeah, well, and we have as Texans, we have a peculiar sense of ourselves and of our place. We take seventh grade Texas history, salute the Texas flag in classrooms. There's a sense of...
But there's also these big gaps of amnesia in our history.
Yeah.
And it's like, there's maybe one line in every seventh grader's Texas history book about Paul Ferguson being impeached,
uh-huh.
and then Ma Ferguson, his wife becoming governor.
Right.
And there's not a whole lot more there.
Right.
There's really nothing there about Pass the Biscuits Papio Daniel, mm-hmm. and his shenanigans as Texas governor.
Uh-huh.
So there seems we don't really pay a lot of attention to the ne'er-do-wells and villains that have really shaped the state.
Well, yeah, and I think Texans like to think of their history in a positive light. Everyone does. Everyone wants to imagine themselves as coming from a benign place. But Texas is much more complicated than that, and it's much more violent, gruesome. Very disturbing place at times. A lot of terrible things have happened here, and so it's important, I think, to tell the story as frankly as possible, and to include the villains as well as the heroes, and also I think not to see so starkly a divide between heroes and villains, because there was a lot of ebb and flow among those guys, and so people are complicated, states are complicated. The past is something that's difficult to judge from the present. It's not probably right to judge people who lived long ago by our own standards. But it's also important to face up to the reality and to the actual facts, and not to try to just sort of turn it into a mythological story.
So what was the something that surprised you as you were exploring Texas history?
I think, one of the things that surprised me, I guess it surprises the right word, but really struck me, was the fact that there is such a thing as a Texas identity after all this time. Texas is, I think, 268,000 square miles. It's a vast place with, you know, sea coasts and forests and plains and prairies and deserts and mountains. It's been fought over by all sorts of people for, you know, 500 years that we know about. And it's been the home to immigrants from every part of the world, every part of the country. And it's still, there's still this thing about being a Texan that hasn't gone away, that hasn't been totally diluted. And, you know, you go up on Interstate 35 and stop at Bucky's or someplace like that, and you see how invested Texans are in Texas identity.
Right. But, okay, so part of the Texas identity has been deliberately shaped by forces that want Texans to think that they are one way, and maybe they're not actually that. So when we talk like cowboys, mm-hmm. so, the cowboy is a rough, independent, rugged guy out on the plains. Mm-hmm. And then we talk about the cowboy strike. Mm-hmm. You know, and so this is when all the cowboys in Texas went on strike mm-hmm. because of poor wages and dangerous conditions.
Right.
And so that seems like, how can that be? It seems like a contradiction, but that's actually history. That actually happened.
Sure. And history is contradictions. History is complications. And it's, I think the human impulse is to try to tell the story of a place or of a people simply. But it's far more interesting to burrow into those contradictions and to look at somebody, I don't know, like say Sam Houston or Lyndon Johnson, and see the dark side and the light side of those characters, and not to portray them just in a one dimensional way.
So the violence of Texas history, you know, lynchings happened here. Jim Crow happened here.
Sure.
We lynched people who we thought were sympathetic with the Union. Mm-hmm. That was these are some of the horrors that, mm-hmm. that made Texas, Texas.
Yeah, when you think about, say, the lynching of Henry Smith in Paris, Texas in 1893, you can't read about this without being completely horrified. The way this guy, who was accused of killing a three-year-old white girl, he was a black man, and he was not just executed, he was methodically tortured for hours in front of 10,000 people in Paris, Texas.
But, and also, it shouldn't have any bearing on anything, but there was no evidence of anything, right?
Right. I mean, he was never convicted. I mean, there was thought to be circumstantial evidence that he might have done this crime. He may have or may not. Nothing excuses the way that he was tortured and lynched. And what was striking to me when you look at Texas history and you read about a guy like what happened to this man, and then you think about how terrified Texan settlers were of torture at the hands of the Comanches, say. And yet they were doing the same thing to this guy in Paris, Texas, as the Comanches were doing to people that captured or killed. So it's the idea that there was a kind of that one side was savage and the other side was noble is completely bogus. I mean, people are people and they are very complex.
What do you think was the significant, like, if a single moment that changed the direction of Texas history?
One really important moment came in the 1680s when the French explorer La Salle had tried to plant a colony in the New World, and in Spanish New World, and he meant to establish that at the mouth of the Mississippi. But he overshot the Mississippi and ended up on Matagorda Bay. And had that colony worked, there would have been this gigantic imperial struggle between Spain and France over Texas that, you know, France might have won. And the Spanish were terribly nervous about the idea of a French incursion into Texas. And fortunately for them, unfortunately for La Salle and his colonists, most of them were killed either through misadventure or by an attack by the Caranquas on their colony.
But it was when word got back to the crown, the Spanish crown, that this that France had made that attempt. Mm-hmm. That's when they gave the order to begin settlement of Texas, mm-hmm. and San Antonio was established.
Well, San Antonio, yeah, was established in 1718, or was the first mission was built here, and
as a reaction to that,
they tried to create a buffer zone of missions in East Texas at first. That didn't quite work, and they retrenched back to San Antonio. But Spain did not want to lose Texas. It was it was a important at that point. It hadn't been. It was kind of a void to Spain. They didn't quite know what to make of it, or what to do with it. But they needed to create a buffer zone against the French.
When we talk about Texas, people think about Texas being part of Mexico. Mm-hmm. Texas was really actually only part of Mexico for about 15 years.
Yeah, right.
It was more for over a couple of hundred years. We were part of Spain.
Right. And we weren't even we say we, but we were, there was no Texas as we think of it today. There was a province and then a Mexican state, Coahuila y Texas. But, the boundaries of Texas, which we all recognize today, those weren't settled until 1850.
And why is it that we need to remember that? Why are all these things? So people say, oh, this is it academic that we know this and that this is why things were founded, or should we have this knowledge at our fingertips because this informs us how?
Well, I think just because learning is fun. And I think in my opinion, it's vital to know about the place where you live. It's not just, can you imagine, moving to San Antonio and not knowing that it was once a Mexican city, and you see the identity of this place and the vitality of it, which so much of it comes from Mexico and from Spain. I mean, to be indifferent to that or to be ignorant of it just seems like kind of foolish. I mean, I think it's really important for any human being to pay attention to where they live and to sort of look under the hood a little bit and see what happened here before.
But you go downtown, you see the big plazas, you see the cathedral, you see how the city is laid out, mm-hmm. in the central part of the city. You see some of the architecture, mm-hmm. The Moor influence, mm-hmm. there. It's part of the hardwiring of this place, on Earth, and right. its connection in time.
Mm-hmm. I mean, those streets were like, you walk down Commerce Street from the cathedral and go up to Alamo Street and take a left and you're in Alamo Plaza. That's the same route that the Texians in 1836 were following when Santa Anna invaded San Antonio, or didn't invade, it was his own country, when Santa Anna invested, say, San Antonio, and the Texians retreated to the Alamo.
Yeah, and just knowing that the Alamo had been a fort previous to that, wasn't just that one time with mm-hmm. with the Santa Anna and Davy Crockett, but it had also been a fort occupied by the Mexican forces, mm-hmm. and that the Texans took that away. And then that's part of it. The history is more than what you're going to get from just a casual glance.
Right.
And it all informs us about who we are. Oh, we're taking a break. We certainly want to hear from our listeners. What about Texas history fascinates you? Does your family have a connection to Texas history? Call in. The number is 210-614-8980. We're going to be taking a break for our pledge drive, and we're going to continue our conversation with Stephen Harrigan, author of Big Wonderful Thing, A History of Texas, when we come back. Stay tuned.
Immigration.
I think we need to all get in before the wall goes up.
Health.
The Promotora, they have all the resources that can get them the help that they need.
Art.
There's this kind of subversiveness to it, right?
We cover all these topics and more on Fronteras as we examine issues along the border and beyond. I'm Norma Martinez. Download Fronteras where you find your favorite podcasts.
We are in the middle of our fall Pledge Drive. I'm Kim Johnson, the producer of The Source. We wanted to let you know that to help move this Pledge Drive toward a successful conclusion, we have a challenge going on right now till 2 p.m. The Minnie Stevens Piper Foundation and the Capital Group are offering us an opportunity to earn an additional $5,000 for our Pledge Drive if we can raise $15,000 today before 2 p.m. All pledges at the basic member level of $5 a month or more count, whether new, renewing, or an additional gift. Please help sustain your source of news and information by making your call right now to 800-622-8977, or you can go online to tpr.org.
Important decisions are happening year-round, and The Source is here to keep you in the know. And as a listener, you play a key role in every conversation. Earlier this year, we hosted the candidates for San Antonio Mayor and City Council. These live forums help hold accountable the people campaigning to represent you in public office.
The Source actually made news when Dave interviewed then-mayoral candidate Greg Brockhaus and pressed him about a police report documenting an allegation of domestic violence, which Brockhaus had insinuated was made up as part of a conspiracy against him.
So you've said some things, made some allegations right now that I have to go back to clarify.
Yes,
sir. Now, you're saying that this report is 100% false.
Look, the report is chock full of inaccuracies and errors.
But you said 100% false.
Oh, it's false. The situation did not occur, period.
Did someone manufacture that?
I have no idea. I don't know what Brian Chasnoff's source is. I have no idea. For instance, the report says that I lost my job and I was drunk.
Okay.
At that time, I was employed at the city of San Antonio. I didn't lose my job. So it's the inaccuracies are huge.
But I have to really kind of take this one thing at a time. So the report is like completely like someone made it up on their computer and printed it out.
I don't know. I'm only looking at what
I said. Well, then that would be a crime.
I don't know I'm just looking at the report itself. That's what I'm looking at. We dispute it. My wife has 100% been clear and on the record of that. And I have too. And for people that say I haven't spoken about this or I haven't talked about this, you know, I've been talking about this since March 21st when the story was written. We've denied it. We've been consistent. And my wife and I are going to continue down that path and because it's the path of truth.
So, I mean, I just have to keep saying that you don't know if this piece of this report
that
the Express has, if it's completely manufactured.
Oh, no, I don't know. All I know is when I see this.
So you don't know if there was ever police coming to your house?
My wife and I deny that situation. We've 100% on
that. So there was no encounter with the police on that day?
100% my wife has denied that report and that allegation.
So I just need an actual, so you are saying that there was the whole thing never, ever, ever happened?
No, that did not happen.
And someone created this report out of whole cloth.
No, I don't know what that means. I can tell you.
Well, if the police had come to your house, they would have made a report. If they didn't go to your house, someone created it out of thin air.
Hey, I'm telling you again, 100%. The situation did not happen. I mean, you're attempting to dig into something I don't have the answers for, and I understand it. I mean, you want these answers. People want to hear. Why? And Greg, why this? Why that? Why'd you do this? And this has turned into a political sideshow.
Right. So to be clear, I have to be clear on this because, you know, people are listening and people want to know what exactly is happening here. You're saying that piece of paper was manufactured by somebody in order as a campaign hit job on you. It has no basis in reality. It is not connected to the San Antonio Police Department. Someone committed a crime. Falsifying.
No, I'm not saying that.
You're
drawing this out.
I'm trying to figure out what you're saying.
I'm telling you the report is false.
It's not true. It's not connected to the SAPD.
The report is not true.
In interviewing Brockhaus, Dave did not let up. He pushed back and he asked hard questions. When you support Texas Public Radio, you're supporting journalism that helps hold the people campaigning to represent you in public office accountable.
And to follow up, we now know that the police did go to the Brockhaus' house that evening and that Greg Brockhaus has also asked for an investigation into the leaking of that police report. And he was doing that at the time when we were having that conversation. So he wasn't being candid at all about what his knowledge of that report, because that report was true. And he was saying that it wasn't. And we were able to talk about that and bring that to the listeners and to the people of San Antonio as they were getting ready for this critical election.
And that's what The Source is here for, what Texas Public Radio is here for every day, to help break down issues, to speak truth to power, and to give you a chance to tell us what you think, to ask questions, and to share your experiences. If you find value in this real, reliable resource, please give one of our volunteers a call at 1-800-622-8977. Or go online to tpr.org and click that red donate button to support Texas Public Radio and The Source.
And now we're back with our conversation with Stephen Harrigan, author of the book Big Wonderful Thing, A History of Texas. It's a 900-page plus book looking at all these different episodes in Texas history. Is there, Stephen, the number is 210-614-8980 if you want to call in and tell us about your take on Texas history and your family's role in Texas history. We'd love to hear that. So is there an arc? Is there a theme? What can we learn if you read all of this book? What are we going to do?
Well, I sort of resist the idea of themes. It's a story to me. And there's no thesis that I'm consciously presenting anyway. But I do think it's a coherent story about the development of an identity. And we talked a little bit about that Texas identity before. And it's a more complex identity than I think people might have been aware of, 100 years ago or so.
So, like, when I go to the rodeo, uh-huh. and I look around and I see people in their Western get-ups and stuff, and they act like they're preserving Texas history, but that's still myth preserving. That's not real Texas history.
Well, it's part of Texas history. And the thing about the myth of Texas is it kind of infiltrates the real history. So sometimes when you're writing the history of Texas, you have to be conscious of both those things.
But it's also much more multicultural, multiracial.
Sure, yeah. And I think, going back to that Centennial Exposition in 1936, which was an attempt by Texas, I think a very conscious attempt, to define itself and to distance itself from the South, to create a kind of Western-centric identity.
Yeah,
for
LBJ
Texas.
Always wanted to say Texas is West, it's not
right.
The South.
Yeah, right. And he wore a Stetson hat, and he had a ranch. And, I mean, all that, there was a... Texas is different. I mean, it's different from the rest of the South. It was not quite as defeated. It wasn't devastated during the war in the way that the rest of the South was. Also, it has a tremendous sort of counterweight to the Southern identity because it's got this Western part of the state, and people became invested in the idea that cowboys were the dominant icon of Texas rather than, say, a plantation culture or certainly a slave culture. So even though Texas was founded, the Texas we know today was founded upon slavery, and that the cotton economy could not have worked without all these enslaved people, we've tended to either forget that or consciously ignore it when writing Texas history and when sort of conjuring up what it means to be a Texan. But, those enslaved African Americans who were brought here are as much part of the creation story of Texas as anybody else.
And also the methodical way that the state has tried to disenfranchise African American population from we had the white primary system mm-hmm, in Texas
right.
In order to keep people from voting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean you had to say I am a white man before you could vote in the Democratic primary at one point.
For 30 years, 40
yeah,
years.
Yeah, it was a long time. And that does, we're not even talking about the legacy of racist thought against Mexicans and Mexican Americans too. I mean, Texas is unique as a part of the South in that it had it has this huge long border with Mexico, which has always been the Rio Grande has been a very contentious zone between Texas and Mexico and between the United States and Mexico, as we see today. With the border wall and all the conflict about immigration. But what people forget was that Texas was born out of illegal immigration. But it was the flip side of it. The Mexicans were terrified of the illegal immigration from the United States in the 1830s.
From people, the filibusters from like Davy Crockett was an illegal immigrant.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily call Davy Crockett a filibuster, but
he was an illegal immigrant.
He was coming here to become a legal immigrant. You know, I mean, people were you know, the Austin and those guys were Mexican citizens, and that was a very conscious decision on the part of Mexico to create yet another buffer zone. They were trying to create a buffer zone against Americans, and they were trying to make American settlers into Mexican citizens, and it worked until it didn't.
When oil with Spindletop, when that became part of Texas, how did that change the state?
Well, it changed Texas from an agricultural economy to an extractive economy, and it exploded the economy of Texas. It was subtle at first. It wasn't subtle. That Spindletop gusher was pretty impressive, but it they didn't know what to do with oil at first. You know, there wasn't
wasn't a market for it.
Wasn't a market for it. So, but it became, of course, we talk about the cowboy, the wildcatter is another iconic figure in Texas history, and it created not just this booming economy that is roaring ahead today, but also a cultural identity that we've taken to heart,
and then also the tech entrepreneur.
Yeah.
Is also part of the Texas identity as well. Jack Kirby, not the comic book
Jack
guy,
Kilby, yeah.
But the guy who invented the silicon chip.
Yeah, Jack Kilby was a guy who was like Sam Houston, like Davy Crockett. He was a recent immigrant to Texas. He had gone to work for Texas Instruments. One day, everybody was on vacation, and he got curious about how to create an integrated circuit, which is a thing about, you know, the size of your thumbnail, but, you know, created, you know, the high-tech boom, basically, that we're seeing today.
And it's Texas Instruments, and they became, they were like the precursor, the prototype for Silicon Valley that we mm-hmm. have today.
Right, yeah. And you know, all that started with a guy in a basement, you know, and a guy, you know, with a lot of curiosity about how to create an integrated circuit.
But so Texas has also been a proving ground for a struggle for civil rights, for equal rights. This is it's been progressive at times and then conservative at other times. And it used to be a solid blue state, then it became now it's solid red. And who knows where the future lies uh-huh. for Texas. When we come back from the break, we'll see what clues we can draw about the future by looking into the past with Stephen Harrigan, author of Big Wonderful Thing, History of Texas. And the number to call in is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. The Source continues right after this. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking with Stephen Harrigan, author of Big Wonderful Thing, A History of Texas. And let's go to the phone lines, 210-614-8980 with Eugene. And Eugene, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Yes, Mr. Harrigan, it's nice to be able to communicate here with you. And I was going to ask you, do you know the reason that's Santa Ana was released by Sam Houston in San Jacinto?
Yes. After the Battle of San Jacinto, Santa Ana was taken prisoner. And the treaty that was signed at that time was the Treaty of Velasco, which was an attempt to get Mexico to recognize Texas's independence. But Mexico did not want to recognize Texas' independence, particularly when its then former president was in the custody of a separatist movement. So part of the reason that Santa Ana was released was in an agreement to try to persuade the rest of Mexico to accept Texas's independence as a reality.
I've heard this story. Tell me if it's true that Santa Ana was addicted to opium, and that then they found him. He was going through withdrawals after the Battle of San Jacinto, and that Sam Houston was addicted to laudanum, which was opium soaked in whiskey, right? And and so after the battle, Sam Houston shared some of his stash with Santa Ana. They got high together, and then they struck a deal.
You may have heard that story. I haven't. I don't think. I mean, there's all this discussion about various drug use by various people in back in that time. And Houston was certainly an alcoholic at that time, or a functioning one, I think. But I don't think that opium story is necessarily.
It's the stories you hear.
Yeah, right.
All right, let's go to Charlotte. Hey, Charlotte, thanks for calling into The Source. You're on the air with Stephen Harrigan.
Well, you all said to call in and tell, your history of Texas.
Yeah.
And I don't think anybody's got my family beat. I have lots of relatives that came to Texas from Spain, but one is Juan Bautista Chapa. I don't know if you...
Oh, are you kidding? Really?
Heard about him.
Sure.
Juan Bautista Chapa, he was the first official, he wrote the first official history of Texas.
Mm-hmm.
The book is Texas and the Northeast, Mexico from 1630 to 1690. And it was, down at the bottom it says, edited with introductions by Wilson C. Foster. I'm not a historian, and I don't play one on TV or the radio, so I'm not real. But the Chapas are going to have a family reunion this summer in the Rio Grande Valley. But I think anyone with the name Chapa in Texas would be related to me.
Well, Charlotte, thank you for that call.
Yes, Charlotte, thank you, because that's Juan Bautista Chapa is a fascinating character in Texas history. One of the reasons for me that I'm so interested in him is because I think he may have written the first poem ever written in Texas. He was with the Alonso de Leon expedition that was trying to find the French colony that La Salle had created on Matagorda Bay. And they came across it, and there were, after it had been overrun by the Caranquas, and he saw these skeletons, including one of a woman in a tattered blue dress, and wrote this poem about her. And as far as I can tell, that's probably the first poem we know that was written in Texas.
Well, written in Spanish or in some sort of Western language, but say things like The White Shaman is a poem.
This could be a visual, you could consider that a visual poem, or more likely an origin story. I don't know if people know what The White Shaman is. It's a pictograph at the confluence of the Rio Grande and the Pecos, one of many hundreds of rock art.
And there were plenty of songs that were sung by the native people.
Yeah, there were plenty of songs, but in terms of written poetry, I don't know of anything before this. I may be wrong.
Yeah, let me go to Mike on the phones. Hey, Mike, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for having me on. So I just had a quick question. I'm wondering, does your history of Texas start with the Spanish invasion, or does it start with some of the histories of the Native Americans who lived here previously? And I'll take my response off the air.
Thanks for calling in, Mike.
Yeah, thank you, Mike. The recorded history, or like written history in Texas, begins roughly when Cabeza de Vaca and Esteban and the two other people who survivors of the Narvaez expedition in 1528 washed ashore on the Texas coast. But what's really fascinating is that there's maybe as much as 16,000 years of history before that. So I try to account for that, but there's not much that we know about it other than what we have. We were talking earlier about the pictographs along the Rio Grande and the Pecos. There's archaeological sites like the Galt site near Salado, which is really important because it shows how deep the history of Texas goes to sort of pre-Clovis tools and spear points and things like that. So I did account for the prehistory you're talking about, and I tried to make sure that when the reader is reading about, for instance, Cabeza de Vaca, you know, washing up on the Texas coast, that we see that through the eyes of the Karankawa Indians who were there, and what that must have been like for them to see these outlanders, you know, showing up on a freezing November day.
So Texas moving forward in about 30 seconds, what can we tell from our future by looking at our past?
Well, I think part of the Texas, you know, we talk about, is Texas going to turn blue and you know, become a more progressive, if that's the right word, state? That may be true, but there is a defiant sort of conservative DNA in our history, I think, that began with the fact that Texas was an independent republic for 10 years, that every minute of that time it was fighting for its existence against reinvasions from Mexico and against Comanches and Kiowas. And so there's a kind of attitude that Texans still have, I think, a lot of them, that we're hostile to distant governments, we're our own place, we're not going to be pushed around. We're going to secede at every opportunity.
But Texas has met multiple times. Exactly. Texas fought against the Spanish rule, then about Mexican rule, and then against the United States.
Right. Yeah.
So what the future holds, it'll probably be some sort of conflict. Stephen Harrigan, author of Big Wonderful Thing: A History of Texas. It was great talking with you.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies, produced by Kim Johnson and Dallas Williams, with production assistance provided by me, Ruben Garcia, and Jan Rospiedad. Dan Katz is TPR's news director. Support for The Source comes from the contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.